Welcome to Soundprint. I'm Lisa Simeone. Living in Baltimore, I've gotten used to the kinds of questions people ask that show they have certain preconceived notions about the city, such as, are there really people there who look like characters out of John Waters movies? Answer, actually, yes. This is one case where the preconceived notion matches the reality. Baltimore is full of wonderful, wacky, eccentric characters. Then there are the wire questions. The Wire, as in the famous, or infamous, depending on your point of view, TV series that ran on HBO for 5 seasons. Many people from other parts of the country think that Baltimore is one big drug deal, with gang members shooting it out on every street corner. That preconceived notion is nonsense. Yes, there are drugs here, just like there are in every city, every suburb, and every rural area in the country. But life in Baltimore isn't a scene from The Wire every single day in every single neighborhood. There are obviously hundreds of thousands of people here who don't have anything to do with the drug trade, which is why, frankly, we need shows like The Wire to tell us about it. We also need shows like today's Soundprint, produced by Deborah George. It takes us inside the drug trade, past and present, and shows us how it's changed. It used to be run by adults, with an adult code of behavior. Now, it employs more children and has become increasingly dangerous. Today's program is called Peanut King's Children.
In the spring and summer months, Greenmount Cemetery on Baltimore's west side is an oasis of shade trees and flowers. 68 acres on a gentle rise, it's a good place to take a break from the grinding pace of the city below. Even on a cold day in late winter, it's peaceful strolling among the tombstones of city fathers, men of science, philanthropists, even assassins. John Wilkes Booth is buried here.
Eating lunch amongst the dead.
I'm here with Larry Grandpree, a former Baltimore City police officer, who right now is peering down into the side streets, ringing the cemetery.
Back. I'm looking to see.
Something has caught his eye.
I'm seeing that person down there walking back and forth.
Grandpree's watching a young man who's walked from his house to his parked car several times while we've been here.
See the guy walking behind the car, walking up to the house?
Why can't he just be an ordinary guy walking up to his house?
Why are you going to walk back and forth to your house 5 or 6 times in a half-hour period? Are you that forgetful? What did you forget? If he ain't selling
drugs. Grandpree says if the man isn't selling drugs himself, then he's probably a lookout.
You know, old habits die hard.
20 years ago, Grandpree worked with a narcotics squad called the Zone Rangers and did surveillance from the cemetery. He'd videotape the activity, spot the guy on the corner selling, the re-up guys who'd bring in new supplies from the drug house, and the security who stood guard. Grandpree was on the force for 22 years. He can tell a saga of generations, how the old-school gangsters from back in the day turned into today's kid gangsters. Melvin Williams, known as Little Melvin, is an old-school gangster and a Baltimore legend. Out on the street, near an old warehouse he's turning into a boxing ring, young boys give him deferential looks.
Tell him, come on down.
This is also where Melvin has his office, in a cramped little room with an old sofa and a desktop computer where he's writing his memoirs. He's quick to remind you, he was never a street dealer.
No, I've never sold the down on the street amounts. I sold to people that sold to communities, that sold to cities, and I never got down that low.
Melvin's heyday as a trafficker was in the 1970s, a very good time to be a drug dealer. One in 10 Americans use drugs on a regular basis. Marijuana, uppers, downers, hallucinogens. Cocaine was starting its run, and heroin was plentiful, especially in the cities. One reason, Melvin says, was Vietnam.
During the Vietnam crisis, there were some organized groups that were bringing narcotics in its purest form back inside of the bodies. They were military personnel. They had control of the casket. So some was actually put in the casket, some was put in the bodies.
That story about the coffins and body bags, it's an urban myth. There was heroin being smuggled back, probably in duffel bags, but returning GIs, with their training as marksmen and their military discipline, were sought after as enforcers in drug organizations. Old-time gangsters like Melvin believed too much violence, especially random violence, was bad for business.
There were no loose cannons running around. It was organizations running things, and there was no drive-by shootings. And you found guys dead from time to time, but they had powder burns all over them, which meant he was the guy that they intended to kill. They got him somewhere where they shot close enough where only way somebody else would get hit, it went through him and hit him. But there were no random shootings, and the old ladies couldn't sit on his steps. That didn't exist.
So into this bountiful and orderly world stepped Maurice Peanut King.
Maurice King was a young man out of East Baltimore that became a major, major figure in narcotics.
Major Alvin Winkler is a retired Baltimore City police officer who remembers when he first noticed Maurice King.
He was a quiet young man. Nobody knew that much about him. How he got started in the drug trafficking, I still don't know to this day.
Peanut was in that transitional stage between the way the old school gangsters did business and the new generation, the Young Turks, as it was called, coming up. He was a very small, slender guy. He was like about 5'5", 5'6", like maybe 130 pounds. The reason he got the nickname of Peanut is because he was so small when he was a child. That was his mother's nickname for him, Peanut. But he had a Napoleonic complex. He made up for his lack of physical stature by being extremely violent.
In the 1970s, Baltimore created a special narcotics squad to deal with the flood of heroin into the city. Alvin Winkler was assigned to it.
The STOP squad, Special Tactical Operations Patrol, basically a plainclothes unit, and we were concentrating on drugs and high crimes within the city of Baltimore.
Gary Child was another member of the STOP squad. He's now a detective in Baltimore County. Child says the squad noticed that King and a friend, Clarence Meredith, were buying up real estate on the east side. It soon became clear to the cops that Peanut King was making some refinements in the way narcotics were traded.
We start seeing King and Meredith on these signs at the grocery stores, and we're like, you know, so what that?
One of the stores was here on North Avenue. It took the police 2 years to figure out how the mom-and-pop stores fit into the drug business.
They were actually selling their heroin for food stamps, and then they were funneling the food stamps through the grocery stores.
The food stamps would be sent to the Department of Agriculture and redeemed for money. So the drugs were laundered quickly, courtesy of the U.S. government. Winkler says Peanut also found a better and safer way to deliver his drugs to his customers.
There was a time that you would go see the dealer, give him the money, he'd give you your drugs, probably meet you in a back alley, some corner and all. With Peanut King, it was different.
Larry Grandpree says that Peanut added more layers to the way deals went down so that the point of distribution became harder to see.
Peanut was kind of paranoid the way most drug dealers are. He didn't want too many people knowing too much. So you know your job. This is your job. This is what you do, and this is all that you do. And this is all that you know. So if you get locked up, you can only tell them about what you know, what you do. You wanted your corner people to stay out on the corner. You didn't want them to have to leave the corner in order to take the money back to a central collection point. So you had people who went out and collected the money and brought the money back to a central collection point. And that's all they did. That's all they did. They would do the money run. And then they'd be the security people. They'd be the guys with the guns who are watching the guys on the corners who are selling the drugs and collecting the money so that they wouldn't get robbed. And then you had the people who ran the drug houses. So it was a vertically integrated corporate monopoly. Or at least he tried to make it a monopoly anyway.
Peanut's biggest innovation, though, was bringing children into the game.
They started utilizing the kids in the neighborhood.
Talking about the 10 to 12-year-olds. And before a 12-year-old in the inner city, and all you're doing is carrying that guy bag and this guy bag, you might do that 10, 11 times in the afternoon, and somebody give you $50. It's very inviting.
He would buy them mopeds, which are like little motorized bicycles. They would be the ones who would go to a drug house. They would get some drugs. They would get on the moped. They would take the moped to the corner boys, the guys who were standing on the corner selling the drugs. And then when they needed some more drugs, they would get back on the moped and putt-putt over to the dope house, re-up, resupply.
These kids would ride around with on the mopeds, and the dealer on the street, when he got the money, would make a signal, and they had a prearranged spot to go. And then the drug addict would give his money to the guy on the street, and then he would walk to the location. The guy would ride by on a moped and hand him the drugs.
The drug dealer would just nod and use hand motions. He never handled any drugs himself.
So they didn't lose as many drugs that way. Kids were hard to catch because they could shoot through holes in the fence, and they were able to elude the police. And, you know, and once you did grab them, then the drugs were always gone. Of course, we would release them, and then the next day or 2 days later, they'd be out doing the same thing, kind of laughing at us.
Those mopeds, nobody else had done that before, and that made his drug trafficking spread out because they were mobile. They could get around. I mean, that just showed the ingenuity of Peanut King.
The moped brigade also saved Peanut King money. Carol Ofer was a young cop at the time. She says in those days, juveniles were booked at the local precinct, and most of the time, they were sent right back home.
I remember locking up one kid, and before I finished my paperwork and got back out on the street, he was out on the street. He was back out there selling drugs again before I got back out there.
Peanut's not an ignorant guy. He was thinking in line that these kids are of the age that caught, they got to be turned over to their mothers. Caught with narcotics on their person, they need to be turned over to their mothers. So until they really zeroed in and found out exactly what the thoughts was and changed a couple of the laws, they were not giving these kids adult sentences. So, you know, I guess you can look at it like this is a free ride, even if I'm caught. Little Joe ain't gonna get but a hand slap and maybe some counseling.
Don't do that again. Go home with your mama. And that's why, because you don't have the liability. You don't have to go get a bail bondsman and pay the bail and then get a lawyer and go to court.
Yeah, I think the parents knew something was going on. I don't think they thought that their kids were maybe dealing drugs, but they knew they didn't buy that moped. And every night they'd bring it home and put it in their basement, you know, and they'd have jeans on, newer jeans, you know, or they'd have to bring food home, you know, bread and stuff from the grocery store. Every once in a while, you know, they would probably get stuff from Peanut's grocery store to take it home, so the parents probably didn't ask too much, you know. It wasn't like they were carrying guns or anything.
Peanut's business innovations extended to marketing.
They started stamping the drugs so that the word would get around. When you had a stamp on a drug, if the addict started saying that the stuff was really good, you know, it had a real good jolt to it, then it was like a form of advertisement. So then everybody was looking for that stamp. You know, they'd go out and actually ask for it.
The Peanut King gang was riding high. They spent lavishly and were regulars on Baltimore's club scene.
Right there. Yep. Right there on the corner. Well, you're right, it is torn down. Yep, it was right there on that corner.
Larry Grandpriest pointing out the spot where the Sphinx Club used to be on Pennsylvania Avenue.
The Sphinx Club was one of the biggest and most glamorous clubs on Pennsylvania Avenue. Everybody came. Police officers came. The criminals came. Everybody came and everybody hung out at the Sphinx Club. It was like neutral territory.
There's a faded photograph of Peanut at one of the clubs. A slight man, tastefully flashy in a fur jacket and matching wide-brimmed hat. In another picture, he's sitting Huey Newton style in a fan-shaped bamboo chair. Peanut tried to impress. He drove a stainless steel DeLorean sports car. The money was pouring in, but laundering it was getting harder.
When he couldn't launder all his money through the store, it got to be too much money, he started going up to Atlantic City. And he would take his money up there, and he would put all, they changed the rules now, you can't do this, you know, the casinos don't let you do this. But he would go up there, and he would put $50,000, $60,000, $70,000, $80,000 into the bank. And when he would put that money in, they would comp the rooms to him. And they would stay there a couple of days. They weren't really big gamblers. They'd stay there a couple of days. They might play a couple of hands of poker. And then they would cash out. And they would get all Resorts International's money. It had all Resorts International's bands around them. And they started putting them in safety deposit boxes.
Or stash them under the floorboards in different houses.
Well, this is Peanut's main headquarters at North and Chester.
Larry Grandpreet was assigned to find the money Peanut had squirreled away.
When he was finally raided and finally taken down, we went and photographed the money, but we used his dining room table as a central collection point for all the money that we found in the house. And the table was about 10 feet long by 5 feet wide. And there was so much cash money piled up on the table that it was falling off the sides of the table.
Confronted with the money, Peanut said, "So what? So we were gambling. Is that a crime?"
But little did they know that the resorts have people behind the walls that keep track of who wins and who loses. I mean, they can tell you within a couple hundred hours. It's amazing. And so when we went up there, we were hooked up with the federal government. The IRS went in there, and they were able to show with their bookkeeping that Peanut never won or lost. He would take fives, tens, and twenties up there and walk back with all hundreds.
With the bands still around the money, they could show the actual days Peanut was in Atlantic City and whether or not he'd been gambling. Peanut King was arrested in June of 1982 and charged under the Federal RICO Act of leading a criminal enterprise. He was sentenced to 50 years. In 1986, 10 more years were tacked on for a prison drug scheme. But what became of Peanut King's children, the Moped Brigade? None of them testified as witnesses at Peanut's trial, and afterward, the police just lost track of them. Most people, like Larry Grandpreet, are sure they stayed in the game.
Even when Peanut was gone, remnants of his drug organization still existed. So a lot of them either stayed with the remnants of his organization, or a lot of them went out and tried to create their own drug organizations. Now that caused friction.
By the mid-1980s, crack cocaine would push the old organizations aside.
And the crack epidemic just made the drug just explode. It was just, because crack was a quicker high, you know, and it was a little cheaper than heroin. And I mean, it was enormous how that thing exploded.
That's when you started seeing Baltimore having 300-plus homicides a year. It changed the dynamics generationally because it was all the young people who was involved in the cocaine business. You know, none of the older gangsters wanted anything to do with it. Besides, most of the older gangsters were either in jail or dead. That left a power vacuum, and we all, nature abhors a vacuum. So that allowed all of these newer, younger, more violent drug dealers to gain prominence in the Baltimore underworld.
Carol Ofer says the first time she remembers seeing a child carrying a gun was around 1990.
The playground at Hoffman and Holbrook. There was one little boy that was actually doing the sales. He was 11, and there was another little boy that was maybe 12 or 13 that was actually the lookout, the enforcer, to make sure nobody came and stole the drugs or stuck him up.
From then on, the tide of violence just got bigger, and according to Alvin Winkler, the drug game got more chaotic.
Today, the foundation of a Peanut King and all is gone, because every little hophead in the world will get a little piece of money, run off to New York somewhere, and get a little bit of drugs and come back, and that's why we got so much violence in the drug trafficking world today, because there's no such thing as territories. See, Peanut King had a certain territory, East Baltimore. It was his. Nobody came in there. Now, people just set up everywhere. Different drugs on the same corner and all, and they get into a clash over customers, and they shoot each other. People trying to rob the dealers because he don't have no big guy looking out for him, no enforcer, and things of that nature. So it's just wild out there. It's the police just running like crazy.
They're kids 11, 12, 13 years old carrying weapons and killing people.
Carol Ofer and Gary Child say there's a fundamental difference between the youthful trappers or slingers in the drug game today and the children Peanut King recruited to his moped brigade.
In those days, they jumped on a moped, ran the drugs around, got their candy and stuff. But now they're in the game. They get in the game early and they end up shooting people at age 14, 15. Mm-hmm. And those kids end up going to jail. But they're doing it on their own now. They're belonging to a gang, and then they've got their own, you know, if you sell drugs, your status increases in the gang. If you make money for the gang, your status increases. In the days with Peanut and Ricks and those, there was no increase in status. They just used the kids, and the kids had a good time doing it. In those days, they stayed kids. Now, they get in the game. They try to increase their status either by selling drugs, getting money for the gang, or shooting somebody.
Like, give me my bars, you know, because they get the tattoos with the, under their eye, the little teardrops to show, you know, how many people I've killed and stuff. It's like a big thing. Like, it's no big deal going to jail now. It's like, yeah, I killed somebody. Yeah, I'm going to go do this bit in prison. You know, it's like a bragging status for them. And it's a big thing for them. And until they get serious about punishing criminals, regardless how old they are, then the cycle is just going to keep repeating itself.
Well, in the federal penitentiaries, as I tell the young guys that I come in contact with, kids, you pick the worst time in history to be a drug dealer. The absolute worst time.
Observing the scene from his headquarters, Melvin Williams says kids today don't abide by the rules.
There are four cardinal rules that we were taught as a kid. First, all strangers are the police. Second, all phones are tapped, the president's included. If you're buying a controlled substance from somebody and you need to take your pistol along, you shouldn't be dealing with him to start with. That's a void purchase. These are called cardinal street laws. They cease to exist with some elders. These kids don't have a clue about them. And more than anything else, the one thing that has to be in the person's mind in a criminal capacity is that he has to remain as a chameleon. He has to try to blend in with every woodwork, or he has to be oblivious, non-existent. These kids don't have a clue about that, because the first time he gets $30, he wants a new Benz, an S-Series. He wants an S500 AG, and all that says to the people in the neighborhood, Little Joe, man, Little Joe's rolling. And it says to the stick-up guys, Little Joe is the guy to start trying to find out where his stash is and where he's laying his head down. And it says to the informant that hangs in the barbershop all day long, Little Joe is the man about town. And it says to the DEA, he's made our job easy. These kids are flat-out ignorant.
Today, new winds are blowing across the drug trade in Baltimore. Outside gangs like the Crips, the Bloods, and the Black Guerrilla family are immigrating to the city, bringing chaos on a grander scale, bringing in more firepower, recruiting more children. Before he retired from the force, Larry Grandpree says he was arresting dealers whose fathers he had put away.
And that's what I was doing at the end of my career. I was locking up the children of the adults that I had locked up when I first started my career. You know, because I think, wait a minute, are you a junior? Yeah, I'm a junior. I locked up your father 10 years ago. I locked up your father 15 years ago. You know, for the same thing, selling drugs. You know, and you know, that's why I say, you know, The drug war, I was around, I started my career in 1973 when Nixon started the drug war, when he created the DEA, and he started the drug war. Now, if we ain't won this war by now, I think it's time to do something else. It's a continuing cycle of violence, continuing cycle of crime. A generation is commonly thought of as 25-year cycles. So you're on third and fourth generations where the family business is the drug business. Like my grandfather was a drug dealer, my great-grandfather was a drug dealer, my father was a drug dealer, I'm a drug dealer, my children are going to be drug dealers. And when it's that ingrained, it's hard to break the cycle.
Peanut King's Children was produced by Deborah George. The show was mixed by Jared Weisbrot. You can listen to this program anytime you want just by visiting our website, soundprint.org. We've also posted links with additional information and reading material. That address again is soundprint.org. Soundprint is produced by the Soundprint Media Center in association with WAMU and American University. On the next Soundprint, Sam grew up as a Midwesterner, but legally, he's a little too Southern to live the American dream.
So right now, the only place that'll take me is IUSB, or Indiana University of South Bend.
And it's not that IUSB is a bad school, but he needs to go to a school where there's more competition. There's not that many instrumentalists at IUSB.
The other thing is that when my dad and I talked to Mrs. Draper, we found out that we really don't qualify for financial aid or loans because of my status. So I have no idea how we're going to pay for tuition.
That's probably one of the hardest things I deal with in my job. We take students where they're at, we educate them, we inspire them to go to college, and then for our undocumented students, we say, we can't help you. You can't get a driver's license, so you can't get to school. You can't have money to go to school. You can't really get a job if you're following the letter of the law. It's like a ball dropping.
May each of you have the very best of good fortune in your futures. We are now declared the class of 2009 graduated.
Sam's story, next week on Soundprint. CDs of Soundprint episodes are available for a small fee by calling toll-free 1-888-38-TAPES. That's 1-888-38-TAPES. Send us a note. Tell us what's on your mind. Your comments help us keep on doing what we do. The best way to get in touch is by email. The address is talkback@soundprint.org. Soundprint is production assistant Nkechi Mogekwu and audio engineer Jared Weisbrot. Our executive producer is Moira Rankin. I'm Lisa Simeone.